The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Coming up on today's program, we're going to be looking back 80 years, the 80th anniversary of the start of World War II. That is on Sunday. There's a large gathering of world leaders meeting in Poland. September 1st, 1939 is when Hitler's forces marched into Poland, which finally, you could say, finally triggered a reaction from the Allied powers. It was 2 days later that they declared war. France and Britain declared war on Germany, and thus the Second World War was underway. We'll talk in the second segment about all that could have been done in the years leading up to that war, all that could have been done to stop it. That, as I say, will be coming up later on today's program. Well, yesterday, the Inspector General released his 79-page report on the former FBI Director Jim Comey and his memos, the memos that recorded his discussions and his thoughts regarding the discussions with President Trump, or in the case of that initial meeting, President-elect Trump. These are the memos, or at least some of them, were the ones leaked to the New York Times through Jim Comey's friend. And as he testified, he did that in order to trigger a special counsel investigation into the Trump presidency, what became the Bob Mueller investigation. And of course, we know how that turned out. Well, Attorney General Barr, as is brought out in yesterday's report, decided not to indict Jim Comey, or the report didn't recommend that should be done. And of course, there's reaction on all sides to this report. This one here from Paul Sperry, he writes at Real Clear Politics. He said, if Horowitz, by the way, was appointed by Barack Obama, but it says if the Horowitz report on FISA abuse, so there's more to come. This is just the first one having to do with the memos alone. But it says if the Horowitz report on FISA abuse is as soft as this one on FBI director leaking and lying, then we are dangerously close to confirming for the American people that there really are two systems of justice inside the Justice Department, one for their own and one for everyone else. Just to bring you up to speed, particularly some of you international listeners, on what this report was about. If you go back to June of 2017, when Jim Comey was testifying before the Senate Intelligence Committee, this is what he said regarding these memos. This is clip one.
I created records after conversations, and I think I did it after each of our 9 conversations. If I didn't, I did it for nearly all of them, especially the ones that were substantive. I knew that there might come a day when I would need a record of what had happened, not just to defend myself, but to defend the FBI and our integrity as an institution and the independence of our investigative function. That's what made this so difficult, is it was a combination of circumstances, subject matter, and the particular person.
So he did it to protect himself, and as he said there, to protect the FBI. So he had these interactions with Donald Trump, and he memorialized 7 of those events, we now know, because of the memos. And some of them were declared classified after the fact, and then others were not declared classified. And we'll talk more about that here in just a second. But here's a little bit more from his testimony back in June of 2017. Clip 2.
Finally, did you show copies of your memos to anyone outside of the Department of Justice?
Yes.
And to whom did you show copies?
I asked, President tweeted on Friday after I got fired that I better hope there's not tapes. I woke up in the middle of the night on Monday night, because it didn't dawn on me originally, that there might be corroboration for our conversation. There might be a tape. And my judgment was I needed to get that out into the public square. And so I asked a friend of mine to share the content of the memo with a reporter. Didn't do it myself for a variety of reasons, but I asked him to because I thought that might prompt the appointment of a special counsel. And so I asked a close friend of mine to do it.
So that was the reasoning behind it. He wanted this special counsel, this investigation into the Trump presidency, the Trump administration, the Trump candidacy. So this report yesterday, 79 pages coming from Horowitz, 79 pages, it shows that Comey repeatedly and knowingly broke FBI rules. He violated protocol. But as I said at the top, the Attorney General, William Barr, he decided not to indict Comey, at least not for the memos. As I say, there's other investigations coming. But as it says in the early pages of the report released yesterday, after reviewing the matter, the department declined prosecution. Thereafter, we prepared this report to consider whether Comey's actions violated department or FBI policy or the terms of Comey's FBI employment agreement. As described in this report, we conclude that Comey's retention, handling, and dissemination of certain memos violated department and FBI policies and his FBI employment agreement. That was the conclusion stated at the start. And of course, Jim Comey focused in on the fact that it had declined prosecution, and he tweeted out, I think it was within an hour, that he was bragging on Twitter for all the world to see. Not 1 ounce of remorse. He said the DOJ, IG, found, this is quoting his tweet, found no evidence that Comey or his attorneys released any of the classified information contained in any of the memos to members of the media. That's him quoting from the report. And then Comey says, I don't need a public apology from those who defamed me, but a quick message with a sorry we lied about you would be nice. So here's Jim Comey asking for an apology. He's the one who should be apologizing for his behavior, for his conduct. He's asking for his critics. He's expecting an apology from his critics. Another tweet soon after, he said, and to all those who spent 2 years talking about me going to jail or being a liar and a leaker, ask yourselves why you still trust people who gave you bad info for so long, including the president. Well, it is true that he leaked and lied. He's admitted it. And then the contradictions, we won't take the time to consider all that he said in interviews, during his testimony, in his book. If you go back, there are some interesting details that are revealed in this report. By the way, we've, of course, spent quite a lot of time over the last couple of years talking about the significance of that transition when President-elect Trump was preparing for the presidency, that time period between early December of 2016 and then, of course, when he was inaugurated there toward the end of January in 2017. And then all of these meetings that went on during that period, Comey himself having that private meeting with President-elect Trump on January the 6th. This was the day after the big meeting with Barack Obama, President Obama, and all of the intel community, the Justice Department, everybody represented there at that meeting. And then it was determined, James Clapper was the one, I think, who suggested that Comey meet with President-elect Trump privately the following day. And you know about some of the details with that. They were going to tell him about parts of the Steele dossier And then that was to be the news hook to get this leaked to CNN. Clapper was the one who leaked that and then said to the president, he was appalled by the leak. So he was lying. Comey went in there and lied to the president saying he wasn't under investigation. All this was going on just weeks before Donald Trump became president. And so then he's also there writing a memo following this January 6th meeting. The IG report says witnesses interviewed by the OIG also said that they discussed Trump's potential responses to being told about the salacious information, including that Trump might make statements about or provide information of value to the pending Russia interference investigation. It says the FBI counterintelligence investigation, known as Crossfire Hurricane, concerned whether individuals associated with the Trump campaign during the 2016 presidential election were coordinating with or had been unwittingly co-opted by the Russian government. So basically, they were sending Comey in not just to reveal these salacious details of the Steele dossier, but also in a way to interrogate this president to see if they could get any information out of him that would be helpful for Crossfire Hurricane, that would be helpful for their counterintelligence investigation into Russian interference, which we now know is just a complete and total hoax. Page 18 of the report, multiple FBI witnesses recalled agreeing ahead of time that Comey should memorialize his meeting with Trump immediately after it occurred. And so there were others involved in these memos. Really, it was like a sting operation. Okay, go in there. You're gonna tell them about this, but be selective. Don't tell them everything. And then also see if you can extract this from him. And then make sure everything is memorialized. And he certainly did do that. Page 18 of the report says, Comey told the OIG he began writing Memo 1 immediately following his meeting with Trump on January 6, 2017. Comey said he had a secure FBI laptop waiting for him in his FBI vehicle, and that when he got into the vehicle, he was handed the laptop and began typing Memo 1. The whole team was prepared. This is the FBI. In January of 2017, this is Jim Comey's FBI, the deep state, all of these Obama officials setting up this trap. That's what it amounts to. So he's handed the laptop. He begins typing his memo. The IG report says he said he continued working on Memo 1 until he arrived at the FBI's New York field office, where Comey gave a quick download of his conversation with President-elect Trump to Rybicki, McCabe, Baker, and supervisors of the FBI's Crossfire Hurricane investigative team via secure video conference. So that would have included Strzok and Page. All of those individuals. Everything pre-planned. He had the secure laptop there waiting for him in the car, collecting information for Crossfire Hurricane, investigating the president, even as Comey was there with the president-elect, saying, you're not under investigation. In fact, he was. We now know that. This is Byron York at the Washington Examiner. It says, Comey and top FBI officials prepared meticulously for the moment. This was not haphazard. This was not, as it sometimes has been presented, this was not, well, it's going to be an uncomfortable meeting, but you better get in there and tell them about these salacious details in the dossier. It was all a setup. We know that with respect to the dossier. They wanted to bring it up so that CNN can run with it. And then here they are, as this report brings out, trying to get more information on Donald Trump, because they were so sure Well, the dossier says it at the top, the very first line. He's a Russian agent, basically. So this is Byron York's piece. The FBI officials made plans for Comey immediately after leaving the meeting to write down everything he could remember about whatever Trump said. Comey also wanted to discuss Trump's reactions with top aides immediately. Comey told the inspector general it was important for the FBI executive managers to be able to share in Comey's recall of the salient details of those conversations. Bureau officials also wanted to be able to respond if Trump publicly misrepresented what happened in the encounter. This is no smooth transition to the next president. They were setting him up. So the preparations were made. Byron York says in his memoir, A Higher Loyalty, Truth, Lies, and Leadership, Comey wrote, he wrote that at the Trump Tower briefing, he assured the president-elect, "We are not investigating you, sir." That's what he wrote in his book. "We are not investigating you." At the moment Comey said those words, he had the Crossfire Hurricane team ready for a secure video conference on Trump's response to the Steele dossier allegation. How about that? He put it all together. There's no recommendation for an indictment. And that seems to be a pretty big mistake. Whether you put it on Horowitz or Attorney General Barr, maybe there's more to come. We'll see. In fact, when you look at the way he tweeted yesterday, you wonder if, as my father's brought out before, if God isn't setting him up for a pretty big fall. We'll see. "We're not investigating you, sir." That's how he remembered it in his book. Even as the laptop was waiting for him in the car and the video conference details were being finalized, my father wrote in the recent Trumpet, "The whole investigation into Mr. Trump was based on a fraudulent, unverified dossier that was paid for by Hillary Clinton and her supporters. That's how these people obtained warrants to begin spying on Carter Page." Well, he goes into some of the details here. But here, all of these agencies, these government agencies, weaponized by Barack Obama in order to go after a political opponent. And so much of this has been exposed, and more of it's going to be exposed. You read through this this report and see Jim Comey trying to justify all of these, well, how he used the memos, government property. But he said, well, it wasn't really government property, at least half of it wasn't, because it was more like my personal memoir, kind of like a diary entry. Page 22 of the report says, Comey told the OIG that he drafted Memo 2 in a different style than Memo 1 because he thought about it differently. Comey said that in his mind, Memo 2 was for me, also for the FBI. But honestly, at this point, I was thinking first about me, close second, the FBI. It says on page 22 as well, when pressed on why he viewed the dinner at the White House as a personal interaction as opposed to an official interaction, Comey characterized it as a mix because he was director of the FBI and also a human being, and he felt that he needed to protect himself and the FBI by being able to remember what Trump said to me, what I said to him, for both of those purposes. It says Comey also acknowledged that it was hard to separate himself from the FBI because the personal assurances that Trump sought from Comey were linked to the power Comey held as FBI director. And so his defense here is that, well, it's okay for me to keep these memos and not even tell the FBI about them because it was for me. It was to protect me. And, of course, the report yesterday says that this is ridiculous, that it did violate FBI protocol, FBI regulations. just going back to that testimony that Comey gave a couple of years ago, here's one more clip from June 2017, clip three.
You said something earlier I don't want to fail to follow up on. You said after you were dismissed, you gave information to a friend so that friend could get that information into the public media.
Correct.
What kind of information was that? What kind of information did you give to a friend?
That the Flynn conversation, that the president had asked me to let the Flynn, I mean, I'm forgetting my exact own words, but the conversation in the Oval Office.
So you didn't consider your memo or your sense of that conversation to be a government document? You considered to be somehow your own personal document that you could share with the media as you wanted to?
Correct.
Through a friend?
I understood this to be my recollection recorded of my conversation with the president. As a private citizen, I felt free to share that. I thought it very important to get it out.
So were all of your memos that you recorded on classified or other documents, memos that might be yours as a private citizen?
I'm sorry, I'm not following the question.
Well, I think you said you'd use classified.
Classified documents. Unclassified. I don't have any of them anymore, but I gave them to the special counsel. But yeah, my view was that the content of those unclassified, the memorialization of those conversations was my recollection recorded.
So his view was that they were unclassified, that they were just his recollections. And then later we come to find out, well, actually, about half of them were classified and half of them were not. But the ones that were revealed or the ones that were leaked, at least those weren't classified. And so the question is, well, who determined what was classified and what wasn't? Who determined that later? Victor Davis Hanson answered that last night on Fox News. Here's clip four.
Well, they keep saying they classified and they. Who is they? And the answer is pretty disturbing, Tucker, because Jim Comey is high-fiving tonight because he said he wasn't indicted or he wasn't going to be referred for indictment. Why wasn't he, given that damning report by the inspector general? And the reason he wasn't was of the seven memos that he memorialized, these were private phone and person-to-person conversations with the president. He took four of them home and he used them as an insurance policy in case something would happen. When he was fired, he used them. And then he said that they were confidential and not classified. Who made that determination? Well, after it all blew up to the press, the FBI panicked and they said, you know, these hadn't been classified or categorized as anything. Let's go back and look at them. And who were they? Who were the four people that looked at them? There were Mr. Priestep, and he, we know, had gone to London three times involved with Christopher Steele and British intelligence. There was James Baker, who we know was leaking to Mother Jones and David Corn to get out the Steele dossier to the press before the election. And in a Orwellian sense, there were Lisa Page and Peter Strzok, no comment needed. So those four people, after the whole thing blew up, they got together and said, let's categorize these. Oh, the ones that Comey took home, we've determined are confidential and not felonious. And the ones he left behind, we will say are classified, but he's not subject to criminal exposure because he didn't take those three home. How hard would it have been to get three or four FBI agents that were not involved in spreading and seeding the Steele dossier and were not confidants of Jim Comey?
The confidants of Jim Comey were the ones who determined that the four that he took home were not classified. They were confidential, and he still shouldn't have leaked it, but at least it wasn't classified information. These four, Priestep, Baker, Page, and Strzok, they're the ones who determined what was classified and what wasn't. And so the IG report yesterday, well, if you look at it, I guess just strictly according to the letter of the law, I guess it wasn't felonious action, as Victor Davis Hanson explained there. It wasn't a felony, the report said yesterday. But look, he was wrong. And what he did was dangerous. That was in yesterday's report. The report that Comey quickly glanced at and then went right to Twitter and said, "You all owe me an apology." Listen to these damning conclusions. Page 52, it says, "Comey's characterization of the memos as personal records finds no support in the law and is wholly incompatible with the plain language of the statutes, regulations, and policies defining federal records and the terms of Comey's FBI employment agreement." Wholly incompatible, it says, with the plain language of the statutes, regulations, and policies defining federal records. That's on page 52. Page 53 says, "Comey's own statements and actions demonstrate the inherently governmental nature of the memos." Page 54, "None of the members of Comey's senior leadership team agreed with or defended Comey's view that these memos were personal in nature." Nobody agreed with that. It says on page 55, "Comey's explanation for his conduct was that he considered the memos to be personal records, but for the reasons previously described, this assertion is without any legal basis." Over and over again. And it builds up to what made quite a few rounds yesterday in the news cycle. Page 60. "Former Director Comey failed to live up to this responsibility by not safeguarding sensitive information obtained during the course of his FBI employment and by using it to create public pressure for official action. Comey set a dangerous example for the over 35,000 current FBI employees and the many thousands more former FBI employees who similarly have access to or knowledge of non-public information. Comey said he was compelled to take these actions. If I love this country, and I love the Department of Justice, and I love the FBI, he said. However, were current or former FBI employees to follow the former director's example and disclose sensitive information in service of their own strongly held personal convictions, the FBI would be unable to dispatch its law enforcement duties properly, as Comey himself noted in his March 20, 2017 congressional testimony. Comey expressed a similar concern to President Trump, according to Memo 4, in discussing leaks of FBI information, telling Trump that the FBI's ability to conduct its work is compromised, if, quote, "people run around telling the press what we do." This is no doubt part of the reason why Comey's closest advisors used the words surprised, stunned, shocked, and disappointment to describe their reactions to learning what Comey had done. So the report concludes that if everyone at the FBI behaved like Jim Comey, they wouldn't be able to do their jobs. They couldn't get anything done. It's dangerous. It's dangerous. And yet, no recommendation for indictment. And so there goes Jim Comey, saying, "I don't need a public apology from those who defamed me, but a quick message with a 'sorry we lied about you' would be nice." What an attitude to be running the FBI for all those years and then a prominent attorney for the government many, many, many years before that. It says a lot about the mentality of those top officials, so many of them that we've talked about over the last couple of years. And it went all the way up to the top, that arrogance, that vanity, the same spirit that let Hillary Clinton off the hook with all the illegal activity she had going on in her basement. And there's Comey yesterday, the same attitude, the same spirit. "You can't touch me. I'm untouchable. I'm loyal. And what I did because I had to do. I had to protect myself. I had to protect the FBI from Donald Trump. He's public enemy number one. Everything we did from the dossier on down, totally justified. That's the way that they think. My father wrote in the August Trumpet, Mueller's efforts were part of the deep state that flowed from President Obama's administration right into Mr. Trump's presidency. Those unelected lawyers think they know better than everyone. He says, I think God set them a trap and then shredded the case for obstruction that Mueller was trying to prove. That's part of God temporarily saving America by the hand of Jeroboam. And so it does make you wonder, particularly when you look at those two tweets from Jim Comey yesterday, you wonder if maybe this is just the first of several investigations coming from John Durham, from Attorney General Barr. There's another IG report coming out on FISA abuse. So we'll see where this goes. But we know that God's hand is involved to some degree. We know that God is temporarily saving America by the hand of Jeroboam. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. When we come back, we'll focus in on some important history from 80 years ago. We'll be right back.
KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Fleury's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily.
On September the 1st, 1939, the Nazi army smashed into Poland. France had a treaty with Poland. Would they act now? At home, we listened in suspense.
Adolf Hitler's all-out attack on Poland makes the long-dreaded European war a certainty. Prime Minister Chamberlain of Great Britain gave the Nazi dictator a zero hour for withdrawing his troops from Poland. That zero hour ends now. At this time, we transfer you to London for an important announcement by the British Prime Minister.
Up to the very last, it would have been quite possible to have arranged a peaceful and honorable settlement between Germany and Poland. But Hitler would not have it. But a situation in which no word given by Germany's ruler could be trusted, and no people or country could feel itself safe, has become intolerable. Now, may God bless you all, and may He defend the right, for it is evil things that we shall be fighting against, and against them I am certain that the right will prevail.
6 hours after Great Britain declared war on Nazi Germany, the Republic of France followed. All France is in a maelstrom of activity. The Maginot Line has already opened fire on the Germans. The sparring is ended. World War II has begun.
That's an old newsreel from the 1930s, 1939, September 1st, the 80-year anniversary of the start of World War II. There's an article at Newsweek by Ariel Cohen. This is from just a few days ago. And it's in response to the G7 that happened last weekend. And this columnist says it laid bare the West's leadership crisis. There's a leadership crisis today, he says. It says here, the first lesson is that he's trying to draw on lessons from this history. The first lesson is that strong leadership is necessary to deal with challenges. If not for Franklin D. Roosevelt and Winston Churchill, well, I don't think Roosevelt rises to the level of Churchill, not by a mile. It says the world could have been a much darker place than it emerged in 1945. But he says this, today we're witnessing the collapse of leadership in the West, which is dragging whole countries down with it. What with Britain mired in Brexit, France shaken by yellow vest protests, and Germany stuck in an immigration crisis, political polarization, and a painful power transition. Continental Europe views the U.S. with great suspicion, and no wonder. America, once the unquestioned leader of the West, is sinking into the toxic miasma of partisan politics and increasing extremism on the right and left, despite an overall positive economic performance. He says the second lesson of World War II is that it's better to meet challenges early and with a united front. Together, the West could have stopped Hitler's murderous insanity in the 1930s. They could have stopped the war before it even got started. That's what he's saying. That's what Churchill said following the war. He called it the unnecessary war. It was totally unnecessary. If we would have just acted, if Britain or France or both of them would have stood up to that Nazi menace. Did you know that less than a year, it was 11 months before those events that you just heard about in that clip, 11 months earlier, Neville Chamberlain came back from a meeting with Hitler. He had several, in fact. Waving a piece of paper. Peace in our time. And the people of Britain, they were excited. They were rejoicing. Just 11 months earlier. Here's some sound from that announcement. This is Neville Chamberlain, clip 6.
This morning, I had another talk with the German Chancellor, Herr Hitler. And here is the paper which bears his name upon it as well as mine. Some of you perhaps have already heard what it contains, but I would just like to read it to you. We, the German Führer and Chancellor, and the British Prime Minister, have had a further meeting today and are agreed in recognizing that the question of Anglo-German relations is of the first importance for the two countries and for Europe. We regard the agreement signed last night and the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again.
That's Neville Chamberlain. in September of 1938, September 30th, and 11 months later, Germany marches into Poland. And if you just look back at that peace in our time declaration, just to get that, the Allies basically had to throw Czechoslovakia to the wolves. They told Hitler, all right, you can go ahead and take over the Sudetenland. Czechoslovakia had no voice. What they thought about their country and their boundaries, it didn't matter. Chamberlain and France, they had to sacrifice Czechoslovakia to preserve the peace. What they thought was peace. That was just one of many catastrophic mistakes. You look back at the lead up to the start of World War II, you can go back several years. The Nazi Party coming to power in January of 1933. And then the Nazis burning the Reichstag in February. In March of 1933, Hitler obtains dictatorial powers. He's got a full dictatorship in March of 1933. In April, the following month, he establishes the Gestapo, the Nazi secret police. He banned the trade unions in May of 1933. That same month, the Nazis burned 25,000 volumes, books that were considered to be un-German. Burning books. By July, all political parties, except the Nazi Party in Germany, were banned. And then in October, Germany withdraws from the League of Nations. And following that, you have all of this persecution unleashed on Jews, anti-Semitic laws. This was happening all through the 1930s. In 1935, Hitler openly declared that Germany was going to ignore the Treaty of Versailles. He establishes the Luftwaffe, the Air Force. He implements conscription for all German youth. Where was Germany going with all of this? What was the plan for Hitler? Well, it was pretty well laid out for all the world to see in Mein Kampf and other publications as well. But the leadership in Britain, until Churchill came along, they were believers in appeasement. Things like sacrificing Czechoslovakia to the wolves. Lloyd George, he was one of Britain's most prominent leaders during the World War I era, but he was still around in the 1930s, and he praised Hitler in 1935. He praised Hitler as the greatest German leader of the age. This was what some of the most prominent British politicians were saying about Adolf Hitler. Even as he was about to militarize the Rhineland, he did that in March of 1936. France could have easily stopped it. France had the most powerful army in the world. They violate the Treaty of Versailles. Well, I think it was even another treaty, the Locarno Treaty. Waltz right into the Rhineland, and the world doesn't do a thing about it. Hitler, by the way, after he took over the Rhineland, he got up in front of his followers at the Reichstag and said, "That's it. As far as aggression goes, that's it. Germany's never going to break the peace." And then every leader in the West just totally relieved. Oh, that's great. That's the end of it. No more disruptions. No more disturbances. No more belligerence on the part of Germany. Churchill listened to that speech by Hitler in March of 1936, and he said that Hitler's message was a comfort for everyone on both sides of the Atlantic who wished to be humbugged, who wanted to be lied to, who wanted to hear smooth things. Well, that was in March of 1936. And 2 years later, German troops march into Austria. Churchill, remember, he compared that Nazi menace to a boa constrictor that devours its prey but then takes a little bit of time in between to digest. And so this is the way Hitler operated. He'd devour the Rhineland, and then it was on to Austria, and then it was on to Czechoslovakia. And by that point, I mean, it's getting serious. And the Allied leaders, they've got to talk to Hitler, try to talk some sense into him. Chamberlain, after meeting Hitler at Berchtesgaden, he said, this is in September of 1938, he said, "I got the impression that here was a man," he's speaking of Hitler, "here was a man who could be relied upon when he had given his word." Well, you can trust Hitler. Hitler had already taken over Austria, militarized the Rhineland, all of these anti-Semitic policies being implemented, the establishment of concentration camps, book burnings, full dictatorial powers, banning all political parties, building up the Luftwaffe, building up the German military, all of that going on with a sense of urgency in the 1930s, even as the Allied nations were meeting together to try to please Hitler and to give him and his army parity with the French army or the British army or the British Navy. So they were working to downsize. Because, after all, we just need a level playing field. And then Germany's right to feel like they're at a disadvantage. And they're right to feel like, well, why should you be more powerful? We should be powerful too. So Chamberlain meets with Hitler and says, I think he's an honest guy. September 17th, he said, "The impression left on me was that Herr Hitler meant what he said. My view is that Herr Hitler is telling the truth." That's what Chamberlain, the leader, the Prime Minister of Britain, said about Adolf Hitler 11 months before the start of World War II. Really, World War II had started. It's just that there was no opposition to it in the Rhineland in 1936. Or in Austria in 1938, or in Czechoslovakia in 1939. Finally, Poland in September of 1939. Did you know that in February of 1939, you know about the peace negotiations in 1938? In February, as late as February 1939, Chamberlain wrote in his journal, "I myself am going about with a lighter heart than I've had for many a long day. All the information I get seems to point in the direction of peace. And I repeat once more that I believe we have at last got on top of the dictators. I feel like that we finally have peace." My father's brought out before on one of his programs that there were people in the as late as 1938 and 39, commentators saying that we're entering into a golden age. You talk about living in fantasy. Chamberlain's writing that in his journal, even as Hitler's preparing to march on Czechoslovakia. And then you had the news media writing about Austrians or Czechs saying, "Well, you know what? I think they actually like Hitler.
I think they actually want him and his army to occupy their nations. This is the treasonous media of the 1930s. Forget about today. This author at Newsweek, he's saying we need to learn some of the lessons from World War II. How about the lesson of appeasement? We often forget just how close we came to losing everything, our freedoms, our liberty, our nations, our youths. Well, in the end, we did lose so many of our youths, 60 million of them, because no one stood up to this. The Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, that was just a week or two before Germany invaded Poland. And then finally, that was September 1st, 1939. Sunday's the 80th anniversary. And then Chamberlain demanded that Hitler withdraw his forces. There was not even an immediate declaration of war. That didn't come until September 3rd, 2 days later. Finally, Britain and France declare war on Germany. And 5-6 years later, an estimated 60 million human beings slaughtered. The unnecessary war. Totally unnecessary. The Apostle Paul says in 2 Timothy 4, verse 3, "For the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but after their own lust shall they heap to themselves teachers having itching ears." Now, this is for the end time. This is not about the 1930s. This is for the last days. He writes about the last days in chapter 3. He says people are going to want to hear smooth things. Verse 4 says, "And they shall turn away their ears from the truth and shall be turned unto fables." Winston Churchill, following Neville Chamberlain's peace agreement with Hitler, he gave a speech saying that this represented a total unmitigated defeat. Very famous speech. But he said in this speech, "I do not grudge our loyal, brave people who were ready to do their duty no matter what the cost, who never flinched under the strain of last week. I do not grudge them the natural, spontaneous outburst of joy and relief." He's talking about the way people cheered and reacted to the piece of paper. He says, "I don't grudge the natural, spontaneous outburst of joy and relief when they learned that the hard ordeal would no longer be required of them at the moment, but they should know the truth. They've been lied to," Churchill said. "They haven't been told about the German buildup of armaments and our downsizing of our militaries. And then all these other things going on in Germany, the book burning, the Nazi, the concentration camps, the persecution on Jews. And then all these people being slaughtered. Even if you back up before Poland, during those months that followed Germany's entry into the city of Prague, of course, they helped themselves to the Sudetenland thanks to the Allied powers. But then after that, then they went right into Prague, took over the whole nation. And in those early months, 250,000 Czechs were killed, about half of them Jews. And so the people weren't being told the truth. How important is it to have the truth and the courage that we need to face the truth, to face what's coming? Well, there's more prophecies we could certainly get into. We just don't have the time to cover it on today's show. But think of these many verses about how important it is to have God's truth, the truth Jesus said in John 8. The truth is what sets us free. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email us some feedback, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for joining us all week, and we'll see you next week.